I went on the Preshies group on Facebook the other day. Preshies is a social media hangout place where people talk about mental health and sometimes talk about episodes of the show, our show, the show you and I share together. It's Depresh Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. I went on the Preshies group to ask a question about our guest this week and the reality competition show that she appeared on. It's a really popular show where people in England bake things and are nice to each other. Almost as much a collaboration show as a competition show. Anyway, here's what I posted. We have Kim Joy coming up on the show from the Great British Bake Off, called the Great British Baking Show in the U.S. Has anyone found this show to be helpful for your mental health or just comforting? And if so, why is that? People chimed in. Deanna said, it's one of the few things that makes my brain make the happy chemicals. The low stakes of the contest and the geniality of the contestants make it very soothing. Zoloft on Netflix. That's what Deanna said about the Great British Bake Off. Teresa said, one of my go-to shows when I just need my brain to be quiet for a while. It's so nice to see a show where the contestants seemingly genuinely care about how each other does. Kim Joy was on the 9th season of the Great British Bake Off. Didn't win, but came close. Since then, she's put out 3 cookbooks and a collaborative card game called Kim Joy's Magic Bakery. Maria from the Preshies group said, Kim Joy was a lovely example of what is good about the show. Kind, fun, innovative, suspenseful, gentle, and no needless cruelty. I wanted to talk to Kim Joy about the show, but I also wanted to tell her story. It features a tumultuous home life, selective mutism, depression, social anxiety, and a career in mental health. All of which made her kind of an unlikely candidate, I thought, for what reality television so often is. So I wanted to know about all that. Kim Joy, welcome to Depresh Mode.
Hello. Thanks for having me. Hello.
What was the environment of your childhood? Where were you and what was the living situation all about?
So I was born in Belgium, and my parents aren't Belgian. So my mum is she's Malaysian Chinese, and my dad is English. So my dad was married at the time in Belgium with 2 kids. And then my mum, she came to London to actually study, but she was working too many hours for a visa alongside studying. So she got deported. And I don't fully know the story that well, because I don't know if my mum totally remembers it that well. So my mum got deported and somehow she met my dad. I don't know if it was, but she didn't get deported back to Malaysia. She got deported to Belgium because she went there recently. Or she got deported back to Malaysia, but she met my dad, who convinced her to go to Belgium. I'm not sure, but my dad sort of took her in, but I think he wasn't the best. Like, my dad's not really the best. And he was trying to find, his thing he was saying was, I'm going to find the Malaysian embassy and get you back home, but he never kind of did. And my mum, I think, felt stuck. And yes, then just had kids with my dad, but we all lived in the same house. So my mum, my dad's ex-wife, my mum, and like the 2 kids from previous. So they lived together for like 9 years.
Wow. Yeah. And so, and then it was you and your brother and these 2 other kids from the separate relationship.
So wow. I've got 2 brothers. So I've got my older brother, Kevin, my younger brother, Kenneth. So Kevin came along first and me, then Kenneth. But then we also have our, half siblings there. He's also got another child from previous marriage, but we've not don't know of him, and he's remarried now as well.
Wow. And that doesn't sound like the most stable and healthy relationship, the way you talk about your dad not being the best.
It's definitely not, and I don't have a great relationship with him, and I feel like I don't really explain it very well most times, because I feel like it's really like it's all a long story. And I feel like there's loads to it, really. But I think my main issue was, I think my mum was quite vulnerable, and she is quite vulnerable, and she has a lot of mental health issues herself. And I think she just felt trapped. And it's also like a cultural thing as well, being in, like, you know, you have kids and you're in another country and you feel, yeah, stuck. And I think she felt stuck for ages. I can't remember them ever getting on. And my mum always wanted, she was always like screaming at him. She was like super fiery, is my mum.
Yeah.
You're like, she knows her own mind. She's like, you can't tell me what to do. and she's really funny.
Did that all seem normal to you because you were a kid and you didn't know anything else, or did it have an effect on you?
Yeah, I mean, I think both of those things. So as a kid, I think you always accept that everything that happens is normal because you don't really
compare
have
it to
that.
Anything. Yeah.
Yeah, and your brain's not developed enough, I suppose. But it definitely did have an effect on me and everybody, I think. And a lot of things do stem. I mean, I'm really interested in mental health myself. Like, I did a master's in psychology and I worked in mental health before I went on the Bake Off. And now I, yeah, do all the baking stuff as well. But I think it sort of stems from my childhood and, like, quite a lot of issues and a lot of mental health problems all within my family and stuff like that.
And I understand you didn't speak as a child very much, if at all.
Yeah, so I spoke a lot at home. I was just, you know, chatting. I was actually quite a really chatty. I was very stubborn as a kid, super chatty. It's all fine. But when I started secondary school, so I was okay in primary school, maybe it's just a little bit anxious. But when I started secondary school, I remember I had a best friend, but when you start secondary school, you start like not quite fitting in because people kind of get their like groups and stuff. So I had a best friend and she kind of got a new best friend and I was like, oh no, I'm not the best friend anymore. And they were like best friends. And I used to just not fully like know what to do. So I remember I used to just walk behind them all the time. Like I just walk. And I just got slowly more and more inwards, and just then it was like just suddenly feeling like I can't fit in, I can't talk to people. So I talked less and less, and then suddenly it's really hard to remember, you know, like a lot of things are foggy, but it felt like it just went on forever and ever, which it did. And I just stopped talking in school, because once you have that identity that other people have in their mind of you, you're the one who doesn't talk and you're the weird one and you don't want to draw attention to yourself. And so I just was like, well, I'd rather just remain this person and create this identity at school. I know that I'm not that person, but I just don't want the attention on me. And I always had it in my mind, you know, when I leave secondary school, then I can start working on being myself in public, which is quite, I don't know, I've never spoke to anyone who's experienced it in the same kind of way. And I always use the word selective mutism because essentially I had like specific rules. So even if I went to the supermarket, I'd talk. But if there was somebody around who knew that I didn't talk, or somebody around who knew somebody else that knew that I didn't talk, then I wouldn't talk.
Well, why were these rules in place, and why? It sounds like you had a system set up. I'm curious why you felt the need to establish this system and establish this set of rules.
I think for me, I mean, I'm super, I have a lot, like I always self-analyze and I'm always stuck in my brain. So from what I've thought about it a lot, and it's almost like self-protective, and a lot of things you do in a way is to protect, like, you know, your ego, yourself. And I knew that no matter what, how anybody treats me, no matter what anybody thinks of me at school, they're not actually thinking those things of me because they don't know me, because I'm just this person who doesn't talk, who doesn't, you know, but it's not just not talking. I'd walk in such ways so that I just didn't draw attention to myself. I wouldn't like make facial expressions because I didn't want people to look at me. I wouldn't change the things I'm wearing to school. So it's like, if I had a specific way of dressing, I wouldn't change that. You go around the class and people read like from a book and you take turns, I would not go in and pretend I was sick. And then as it approached GCSEs, I started not going in at all. And I used to just go to the library where I wouldn't work or do anything.
And just for the American audiences, the secondary school goes up to about age 16 or so, correct?
Yeah, it's 12 to 16.
12 to 16.
Four years. And then after that, you go to sixth form or college, which is 16 to 18.
Okay. And the GCSEs are exams towards that. Okay.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't even, like, I was thinking school does involve some amount of speaking, like, you know, calling it attendance or, you know, reading from books out loud to the class. You wouldn't even do that. You would do none of that.
So the main thing that every single time you have to do is they read the register out and you need to go like here, or you put your hand up and say something. And I used to just kind of do the hands as minimally as possible. And I'd try to say here. I think a lot of the issue as well was that I didn't know how my voice would come out. And so I didn't know if I'd end up being too loud or too quiet. And so it kind of came out. Okay, so basically I'd be like a whisper. It would always come out as a whisper. And in my head, it'd be really loud, but nobody could hear it. So if you had to do it, I did it. But then a lot of the times, like most of the teachers, they'd always look up when they came to my name. So I kind of, you don't have to even say anything at that point. And I always remember this, it's always stuck in my head, actually. I had a music teacher who was calling the register and got to my name, and she couldn't hear me. And she's looking around saying, oh, you know, is she here? And I was like a bit like, oh, and then, you know, then she said to me, if there was a fire, nobody would hear you. So you need to speak up. And I remember feeling like really mortified, but I was like, I was fine. But, you know, like everyone else in the class were like, oh, no, miss, that's really mean. Like what you said that. And, you know, she's getting really upset. And then suddenly I felt like, oh, my God, I'm crying. And I felt like mortified because drawn attention to myself, and I just wanted to be this invisible person that nobody spoke to.
Was this a way of establishing some control of your own life in what can be, you know, what sounds like a fairly chaotic home life and an intimidating school life, and you've got depression and anxiety that are bubbling up? Was this a way of you taking control of things?
I mean, I guess you can relate a lot of things to control. And I'd say it goes back, you know, to protecting yourself in some way, for sure. I felt like I had no choice, though. I felt like, you know, I can't just start talking. That'd be there's just no option. There's no option that I could ever do that. Until I left secondary school, I had, you know, it wasn't something I had any choice in. It felt like something I just got stuck into. And I was like, oh, no, this is the way I'm perceived and I can't draw attention to who I am. So I just need to wait it out. And, it, you know, when you're younger, it feels like the longest thing ever. It's like, oh, wow, I've got two more years of this.
Right.
You know.
So then once you got out of secondary school, did the dam burst and you just started talking all the time, or how did that work?
Not quite. Some people stay for sixth form in the secondary school, but I was like, obviously, I need to go to a completely different place.
So it's kind of complicated for us Yanks to understand, but basically, sixth form is the final 2 years of secondary education, about 16 to 18 years old. Students can also go to what's called college for those years. After that, they can go to what Americans call either college or university, and the Brits just call university. Coming up, Kim Joy goes to college and university, talks more, drinks more, starts to bake.
I'm Iffy Wadiway, the host of Maximum Film.
I'm Alonzo Duralde, also the host of Maximum Film.
And I'm Drea Clark, yet another host of Maximum Film. Every week, we hosts huddle up.
Usually with an illustrious guest.
And we talk about films.
We have film news.
We have film quizzes.
We answer your film questions.
It's like the maximum amount of film talk. That's why we call it
Maximum Film!
Maximum Film, the movie podcast that's not just a bunch of straight white guys. New episodes weekly on MaximumFun.org.
Back with Kim Joy from the Great British Bake Off. She's going to talk about CBT, or cognitive behavioral therapy, in a minute. It's a form of talk therapy that sets out to challenge and reroute problematic thought patterns and tackle cognitive distortions. When last we left Kim Joy, she was moving on from her old school and looking for a better life.
I was like, obviously, I need to go to a completely different place. So I went to a college, which was actually not as good as the sixth form in my school, but I just needed to get away. And I tried to break out, but I didn't. I was better, though, but I had no friends and I still felt like the weird one. I still couldn't properly, you know, communicate with people and fit in. And it's only when I went to university that I think, you know, even in college, it's like you're still in the same environment. There's still a chance that people know somebody who knows you before. So you can't fully break out of it. But when I went to university, I was like, right, I'm going to go as far as possible. So I'm going to go to another city. And I thought, I'll go to Bristol. That sounds good. And I kind of like knew in my head what I kind of needed to do. And, you know, at that point, you know, I managed to get like grants, and it's a lot better in the UK because you get like grants and maintenance loans and all of that. So you can be, you know, it's not a ton of money, but you can live off that. So, yeah, I somehow managed to make friends by just, I think you learn that if you drink loads of alcohol and you go out.
Friends come running.
And like, you're like, oh, I'm the bonkers one who drinks loads of stuff. Then people love it because they love the chaos and the drama. They're like, oh, yeah, you know, Kim Jo is just that one who drinks. And like, yeah. And I went to hospital twice for drinking and I don't even enjoy drinking. But
it was a social lubricant. It was a,
yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Had you noticed what you would recognize as depression or anxiety to that point? Did that factor in, or did you just figure this is just who I am? This is my personality.
I've always been really interested in mental health, and I was always super introspective, and I always knew I'm experiencing social anxiety. I always knew I'm experiencing anxiety and depression of a mixture, but I was more focused on social anxiety. I actually went to, when I was in sixth form college, between the ages of 16 and 18, I saw I think what it is a psychological wellbeing practitioner, which is what I then went on to do. So in the UK, the approach is low intensity CBT. So it'd be, you know, you go through like specific worksheets, and for social anxiety, it'd be like things like thought challenging. So you'd have like identifying, you know, what kind of, you know, are your thoughts accurate, or is there some kind of like filter you've got on those thoughts? And I remember going to one, two sessions and then thinking, I know what I need to do. Basically what I'm being, you know, because you have experiments as well set, which is like, you know, try to talk to this person and then reflect on it afterwards. And I was like, I get what she's trying to say. What I need to do is I just need to go out there and just keep doing it. I need to just keep doing it. And so I kind of didn't go at that afterwards. And I was like, I just need to do it.
Yeah. I do want to talk about the Bake Off, but I want to talk about what you were doing before that. So you were in the mental health field. So how would you describe what your job was?
So my initial aim before the Bake Off happened was I really wanted to get into clinical psychology because I love psychology. And it's quite difficult. I don't know how different it is here, but it's super difficult to get into. So you need to gain a lot of experience in different areas. And then once you get that, you do a doctorate, which is a 3-year course. And it's actually funded by the NHS. So you're paid to do it, which is why, you know, it can be quite competitive. I did a master's in psychology after my undergraduate. And then I worked in multiple different jobs because the aim was to get a variety of experience. So I worked as a support worker for people with learning disabilities in the community. And then I also worked inpatient with people with learning disabilities. And then I also, after that, I managed to, it took me forever because I was so awful at interviews. And it's actually really embarrassing when I think back to my experiences at interviews is really, so it took me a lot of time to get jobs and all of them. Yeah. So I got a job eventually as a trainee psychological wellbeing practitioner. And within that job, it's the same. Yeah. So you work with people with, they call it low intensity CBT, but you're training at the same time. So you do a postgraduate diploma course and you are learning like on the job kind of thing. So I've got a qualification for that. And then after that, I totally burnt. I mean, it's a super hard, there's like, you've got a massive caseload. So after that, I worked with students at York University. And I worked with them. That was nicer because it was more like individualized and you didn't have as many people and you're working with them, helping them to plan and organize. And it's much more flexible.
Were you baking all the while?
I thought it was kind of like off and on. So do a little bit and then like life takes over. So when I was doing the PWP stuff, that was like totally not very much.
So yeah, what does PWP stand for?
That's a psychological wellbeing practitioner.
Gotcha.
Okay. So a lot of GPs in the UK will refer their patients to you. So yeah, off and on, baking. I don't think I really fully got into it and had time to properly do it until I met my partner, Nabil. And that was when I came to Leeds and I moved in with him. And it's the first time I've actually got my own. Because, you know, before that, you're sharing houses with people. So it's like you don't actually, you know, it's like a kitchen. And you don't.
Right. You can't make a mess like you otherwise could.
Yeah. Oh, and I was like in a shared house after I finished university. I still had a lot of issues with my social anxiety. And it was never, I don't think it's ever fully cured. But I had this thing where I was like, I'm just going to make friends. Let's just make friends. And I was like, oh, I'm going to go in a shared house with like all these new people because I can make friends that way. But it didn't really work out because as soon as I moved in, I realized actually I don't really want to hang out with these people and we don't have anything in common. And I got kind of back into my old pattern of, I worked in a care home at the time. That was my first kind of proper job. So I worked in a care home with elderly people and I just like sneak in. Like when I came in, I didn't want to bump into anybody because my room was on the top floor and you've got to like navigate all the stairs and like, and then what if they like see you? And I wouldn't go to the kitchen ever, you know, so I wouldn't bake that time.
Yeah, I know. That would draw attention to yourself. Why did you try out for the bake-off?
So I think my confidence really, really increased when I met my partner, Nabil, because I think he's the first person who, I felt grounded for once. Like I've always said, I've never felt like I had any home. And I felt like when I met him, you know, I've got a home and I've got somebody actually who gets me. It seemed like it really, really helped my confidence. And after I was doing my PWP work, I took time out of that and I was working in York with students and helping them. But I was doing that on more of a part-time basis because he said, you know, you've never had a break from work, you know, just, you know, chill out for a few months, figure out what you want to do. And he really gave me that opportunity. So I spent the time, all that time, I was doing a blog and I was doing like all my bakes and I was loving it. And then, you know, he was like, oh yeah. And what about the bake-off? And I was like, okay, I'll apply. And then I applied and then, yeah, kind of, I thought I'd never get on. It's like,
it was a pretty big deal by the time you were auditioning. It was a pretty popular show.
Yeah.
And I am referring to it as the Bake Off. In the States, it's referred to as the Great British Baking Show because Pillsbury has a trademark on the term Bake Off. Mm. So when I go to watch the show on Netflix, it's not the Bake Off. But on this show, on my show, because I own this show, it's the Bake Off. And I'm going to just stick with that name.
You can set the rules however you want.
Look, I'm not afraid of Pillsbury. They can come after me, and I'm ready for it.
Yeah.
I like that idea that you get paid to learn to be a therapist, because then the world has more therapists, and then you would have an easier time getting an appointment. Of course, a national health system makes a difference too.
It could happen to you. You're all grown up now, a professional adult with diverse interests and hobbies, and one of those hobbies is video games.
You just can't help it. They're so good now.
If that's you, we're here to tell you, you are completely normal.
I'm Maddie Myers.
I'm Jason Schreier.
And I'm Kirk Hamilton, and together we form Triple Click, a podcast about video games.
If you think you might be a person who likes video games, we hope you'll give Triple Click a listen.
Triple Click, new episodes every Thursday on Maximum Fun.
Back with Kim Joy from The Great British Bake Off, a show that gives people a lot of comfort in a scary world. Annie from our Precious group on Facebook says, even as the show can be frustrating in terms of the challenges, I continually love how the contestants are so supportive of each other and seem to genuinely bond over their love of baking. American reality shows and competition shows tend to be really brutal. It's become the catchphrase of, I'm not here to make friends. It's like, gets said in every reality show. But on the Bake Off, everyone seems so nice. It's almost like they are there to make friends. Is it really as pleasant and collaborative as it seems to us, the viewer?
Yeah, it's like when you go, I think it's because all of us were like bakers and it's a hobby, but you don't always know that many other people are into baking as much as you.
Right. You're alone in your kitchen. You're not with other people.
It's like, I can't remember who said it. It was another Bake Off person said something like, you know, it's like we're all like, you know, secret bakers. And it's all like a little secret. And then suddenly you're like, oh, you know, other people.
Yeah.
So it's good because even though you're all different people, you all have baking in common. And it's just an incredible experience that only a small number of people have gone through. But at the same time, it's like super stressful. Super stressful, but I think they're just really good at picking. Everyone is lovely. Like, they never pick people who are like not nice in some way.
I think that's part of the popularity is you can watch it and you know that there isn't going to be a villain on the show.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that must have, it's interesting to me that by this point, you've been dealing with this social anxiety, you've been dealing with depression. And you've been dealing with, you have your partner, but you haven't had a lot of close friends. And then here you are among all these like-minded, kind people, but yet also competing against them. Was that just odd or did that seem comfortable to you?
Very odd.
Yes.
But I mean, it feels like another world, place. It is definitely odd, but I mean, luckily for university I did make close friends. Like, I had my best friend EJ. I only had friends. I didn't really have anybody, you know, that was, I just didn't have like that like feeling of like I'm me, or so it just really helped to meet Nabil, be in that kind of place where actually, you know, he is there. You know, every time I have my doubt about social situation and I'll be super anxious about it, he would talk to me and actually make me feel better. And it's weird because the amount of confidence he had in me was bonkers. Like, he said to me, it's almost the point where it's like, this is a bit like pressurizing. Because he's like super secure, which is kind of what you need, because I'm really interested in attachment styles, and my attachment style is a mixture of insecure and avoidance. So I kind of flip between the two, and he's super secure, which is amazing. And so it encourages me to become more secure. Mm. Whenever I'd say anything, I'd really trust his opinion on things. But yeah, when I was applying for Bake Off, he was like, right, just get past the phone call. Just get past the phone call. And when they meet you, if you get to meet them in person, they'll have you on. It's a done deal. That's what he said. And I was like, what? This is like, it's probably not the best thing he said.
I think most people listening to the show probably won't be appearing on a baking competition show. Who knows? Maybe. I don't know all our listeners.
Maybe.
Yeah. But is it something that you can develop? Like if someone has confidence in you, if you've got some of these things going for you, that you can develop that confidence in yourself? And if so, how do you do that? What's the method?
That's really interesting. You mean like confidence in yourself or confidence in baking or a bit of everything?
Well, I mean, let's go with yourself, given your experience in baking.
Yeah. I think it's all about the kind of people you have around you. And, you know, your life can go in so many different paths where maybe you don't meet the kind of people who are, and I think I was very lucky to have met people who really helped me. And I've always felt like I'm really lucky. And I'm just, yeah, I think if you can meet the right people, that makes a massive difference. The problem is often, like, you know, if you have anxiety and depression or especially low self-esteem, you can end up, there's people, you can end up drawing in the people who aren't the best for you. So I was very lucky. And I think I have drawn in a bunch of people who weren't the best for me. And I was just lucky to get Nabil.
you keep using the word lucky. And I question that a little bit, because I think sometimes what we call lucky is in fact earned wisdom.
Yeah, it's a complicated one, is the lucky. And it's almost like, you know, am I just like not giving myself credit by saying the word lucky all the time? And, you know, I do give myself credit. And I think I'm really proud of myself and I'm really proud of where I've got to. But at the same time, I acknowledge that having the right people around does help, and not everyone, you can't just like work really hard or, you know, do the right things to get out of, you know, social anxiety or your mental health problems. You can't always do that. And that's why I'm super conscious of not, yeah, I think I've worked really hard, but at the same time, you know, you can work the hardest, harder than anybody ever, and still be struggling. Sometimes there might be that little bit. You just need that small, small opening. And some people just aren't given those, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. What was it like, you know, as the show started to air, for someone as historically shy as you were to become famous, to be spotted on the street, to, you know, be written about and talked about and everybody online is buzzing about you and praising and criticizing you?
Yeah, that was a lot.
Yeah.
I remember the first time. So it's like my first, because they brief you on the bake-off. So they make sure, like, they're like, you know, this might happen, this might happen. They prepare you for the worst case scenarios. You know, people are going to say stuff about you. And they announced all of our pictures on the Daily Mail, which is like not a place where I should have looked. But yeah, they put your pictures on the Daily Mail. And that's before the show even starts. And I start looking at the comments, which was an error.
Oh, never look at the comments. Don't ever look at the comments.
This is what people always say to me. Don't look at the comments. I'm like, I will do it.
How bad could they be?
Yeah. Well, there was a load of comments about me, because I think they just, you know, they're like, you know, there's like certain faces that, like, oh no, that person's like, they just have opinions. So it's like I had comments saying, you know, like, she's like a clown and all that really horrible stuff. And it stopped me sleeping. I didn't sleep all night. But the next day I was like, right, I'm done with that now. That's out of my system. And then I didn't look again at the Daily Mail. So, and it's almost, I was kind of like, actually, it's good. I want them to dislike me. And I think that was, you know, that comes, it's amazing that I was able to feel that way, because that shows that, you know, there is some confidence there and I do have that. So, yeah. And then when the show actually aired, the first couple of weeks, I had to avoid looking at Twitter and stuff. And my friends really helped me out. They would go through Twitter and scan it for me and give me like the good comments, and then they'd give me a negative comment, but then like make fun of it in some way and just like laugh at it.
Curating the comments as they came in.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And that really helped. And then, but over time, I think the first few weeks weren't, I did get some like negative comments and, you know, you're always gonna, but as the weeks went on, they became overwhelmingly positive and it was really nice.
How old were you when the series was airing?
So I was like 27.
Okay, so we're talking about a little over a 10-year turnaround from not speaking at all to being a TV star.
Yeah.
did it feel good? Did it feel like, oh, now I'm emerging into who I really am? Or did it feel like I'm turning into somebody else?
It felt good. It did feel like, you know, actually people are seeing me more for me. But it did also feel, it is also like everyone's got their, you know, view of you from how, you know, you're seen on the show. And I'm like, it's weird because everyone feels like they know you, but they don't really know you. And, you know, I do have like a personality. I feel like I kind of put on a bit when I'm like, you know, around other people. And it's, yeah, but I mean, it's amazing. And it's really, really helped my confidence. And I would say Bake Off is the best thing I've ever done. And I'm so glad that I did it. And it's weird because you'd think, you know, being socially anxious, why on earth would you go on TV? Most people don't do that.
Yeah. Talk about vulnerability.
Yeah, I've always had this thing where I think it's like ever since I had that therapy I told you where it was like based on it's CBT based. And it's like, well, you just got to do these things. So I was like, well, I've just got to do these things. And so I was like, I'm going to do that thing. I'm going to do that thing. I'm just going to have to keep doing them. And I think I just felt like that's all I could, that's what I've got to do. And I suppose with the TV thing, I don't know, when I think back to it, it's different because you're on television. It's weird. So I'd be way more anxious doing like talking to like somebody, like a group of people who I kind of have met like two times before or something, than people watching me on TV.
Right. Oh, that's interesting. You've been exposed and vulnerable on the show, but you've taken it a step further. You've been very open about your mental health. You've been open about antidepressants that you've been on. There's a very moving Instagram post where you show the pill that you take. What made you decide to be that open?
I saw a friend who's also on the Bake Off, Lottie, and she posted a picture of a pill. And it made me think, I see her as somebody who's probably quite similar to me and somebody who doesn't, you know, you feel like you kind of have to be a certain way and you don't want to be seen as vulnerable. And I thought that's really brave and incredible that she did that. And I just thought, I'm going to do it too. And it made me think because it's something I've been on. So I'd started on various SSRIs when I was like 16, around that time, because I was researching and I knew that you could talk to GP and get that prescribed. It's something that I've always kept to myself, like even with friends who I know really well. And it's weird. And it's ever since then, actually, I've just been like, you know, actually just talk about it. And actually, it's quite, you know, it's weird because everyone I know, most people I know are on an antidepressant. And I don't know many people actually who aren't.
Okay. When you started sharing this, what was the response that you got from the public? And did that response surprise you?
Yeah, it was a really positive and kind, and people feel like not connected to people often, especially with social media and seeing stuff like that. I think anytime you're vulnerable or you say something vulnerable, it brings people together and people connect and people relate it to their own experiences, whether it's similar or different in any way, you know, and it makes people think, just like how Lottie's post initially made me think, actually, I don't talk about this. And I think it's a really good and like a good thing to do, to just like, yeah, this is a thing, because so many people take antidepressants or any medications for their mental health. It's a tricky one though as well. Like, I always try and talk as well about the emotions as well, not just, you know, about taking the medication, but also about everything else that goes on in your brain and the complexities of it. Because mental health isn't simple and you can't just...
Right. Yeah. When the pandemic hit and people were sheltering, I've never been a baker myself, but I have a friend who also wasn't a baker who became one during the pandemic, and she was just in her kitchen and it became a form of therapy, I think, for her. And it became this idea that she could create something that wasn't there and it would come out and it would be beautiful and it would delight the people that she was around. Have you found baking to be a kind of therapy for you in addressing mental health challenges you have?
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's something a lot of people, like your friends, it's something that I would say multiple things, really. Number one, it connects you with your senses and it can be a very mindful activity. And anything that helps you sort of lose sense of time a little bit is really good for your mind, particularly depression and anxiety. Mm. And it's like having that sense of productivity and I'm important and I have a purpose and I can make other people smile, make other people happy. And baking connects you with that again. You're like, I've just created this thing out of like all these ingredients. This is amazing. And then you can also give it to somebody else. And a lot of times you don't want people to be feeling sorry for you or anything. You just want to be able to give something and be like, I'm making a difference to somebody else. And I think that's something I always had. And I think partly why I was really drawn to mental health is, and I wanted to become a clinical psychologist is because through helping other people, that helps me. And baking definitely tied into that. The other thing about baking is there's so many different, everyone can kind of, you can go into it, you know, there's a method. You can just follow the method and learn. You can just gradually build up your knowledge of it. And it's kind of like magic. It's just like seeing something just transform in the oven.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why ovens have windows, I imagine.
Oh, yeah. Oven windows. Oh, and that's the other thing. Like there's this combination, an interesting combination of structure as well as creativity within baking. And you have the structure to guide you and comfort you. And so you don't just feel like, oh, here's this abstract thing I need to do. It's like here, there's a guide to it. And then within that, if you want to be more creative with it, you can. And if you don't, you don't.
Right. You've mentioned in the past wanting to combine baking and mental health work. How do you see those two things working together?
So there's actually a social enterprise in London called Luminary Bakery, and they work with women who face multiple barriers, and they train them up to learn baking skills and barista skills and just, you know, those things like being productive. So up north in Leeds, where I live, I'm an ambassador for a charity called Wren Bakery. And it's based on the same model, but up north, because it didn't exist prior to that. And it's incredible. Like they work with a very small group of women because you can't work with a massive group of people and everyone's, so it's super individualized for everybody. And they have like therapy sessions alongside, but it's also like, you know, you're all centered around and focused on an activity, baking, because it's hard to just like, I think it's quite a weird thing, like just turning up to a therapy session and starting talking. People like, it's like, how? So if you just do it around baking at the same time, you're learning a new skill, you're feeling like, you just feel better about yourself when you're learning something and you're actually taking part in something amazing.
Yeah. Kim Joy, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, John.
Kim Joy has a new cookbook coming out this spring, Bake Me a Cat, 50 perfect recipes for edible kitty cakes, cookies, and more. Stuff in this book is cute as hell, especially if you like cats. It makes me smile. Smiling feels good. Bake Me a Cat is available for pre-order now. Comes out in March in the UK, May in the US. Next time on Depression Mode, we take a wee bit of a break. Yes, we're going to take a little bit of time off, and we're going to bring you a rebroadcast or repodcast of my interview with David Sedaris. brand new show the week after that. Our merchandise shop is open. Yes, you can get Depression Mode merch. We have t-shirts, we have beanies, we have comforters and note cards and sweatpants. It's all available at maxfunstore.com. Just go to the little menu of shows and click on Depression Mode and you'll see all of our stuff. If people support our show, we can keep having a show. If not, not. If you already support Depression Mode with your dollars, thank you. You are making this happen and you are making a positive difference in people's worlds. If you have not yet donated, it's so easy to do. Just go to MaximumFun.org/join. That's MaximumFun.org/join. Find a level that works for you and select Depression Mode. Be sure to hit subscribe, give us 5 stars, write rave reviews. That all helps get our show out into the world. The Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is available in the United States by calling 988. That's it, 988. The Crisis Text Line, also free and always available. Text HOME to 741-741. Our electric mail address is depressmode@maximumfun.org. You can be part of the Preshies group too. It's a great forum. It's a great discussion group. Great people talking about interesting things about mental health. You can find Preshies on Facebook. Our Depression Mode newsletter is available on Substack. Search that up. I'm on Twitter @JohnMo. Also on Instagram @JohnMo. Also on Post @JohnMo. And Hive @JohnMo. John is spelled with an H. Hi, credits listeners. I talk a big game about not being afraid of Pillsbury, but the truth is, if they sent the Poppin' Fresh Doughboy to physically attack me, I'd be terrified. I mean, I'd win, but I would be terrified. Depression Mode is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson, and we get booking help from Mara Davis. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now. Building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out. Building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason. Maybe there's no reason. I just keep believing. No one knows the answer. Maybe there's no answer. I just keep on dancing.
I'm Phil from Pullman, Washington, and I think you're pretty great.
Depression Mode is a production of Maximum Fun and Papa Chick. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.